Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California's Voice of Reform Project, addressing issues related to improving California state governance. I'm Robert Walker, a member of the Board of Governors of the Commonwealth Club and your chair for today. Tonight we will focus on the potential impact on minority communities of political redistricting in California. We also welcome our listeners on the radio. The Commonwealth Club's Voice of Reform programs are made possible by the generous support of the James Irvine Foundation, the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, and Commonwealth Club members. We are pleased to be presenting this evening's program in conjunction with the Institute for Governmental Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Bruce Kane, the Institute's director, will be moderating our program this evening, and it is my pleasure to introduce him. Bruce E. Kane, Robson Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Berkeley, and Director of the Institute of Governmental Studies, is one of California's foremost experts on redistricting policy. Professor Kane has served as a redistricting consultant to numerous cities, counties, and citizens' commissions throughout California, as well as to the United States Justice Department. In 2002, he served as special master for the state of Arizona's legislative redistricting process. Dr. Kane has written and edited numerous books on reapportionment, redistricting, voting, and other political and governance issues, and he serves as a political commentator for numerous radio and television stations in the Bay Area. In 2000, Dr. Kane was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and received the Zale Award for Outstanding Achievement in Policy Research and Public Service. In 2003, he was honored for Outstanding Teaching in Political Science. And now I'm very pleased to turn the program over to Bruce Kane to moderate tonight's discussion. Please join me in welcoming him.
Thank you, Bob, for that very gracious introduction. It is my pleasure to chair tonight's discussion on what is emerging as not only a major topic of reform in California, but it turns out, a topic of reform in a number of states across the country. Redistricting, as I think most of you know, is the decennial exercise of redrawing the district lines to make them as equal as possible after a new census is taken. Now, normally, this process occurs at the beginning of a decade when the census numbers are fresh and new. And in most states, but not all, it's done by the state legislature. Governor Schwarzenegger has proposed giving this task to an independent commission of retired judges, and there are, last count, about 10 proposals with variations on that theme. In addition, the governor has proposed that we do a mid-decade redistricting, that is, do a redistricting before the next election in 2006. That is unusual, but not unheard of. The state of Texas did it just before the last election, somewhat famously. Now, voters therefore may, if a special election is called, get to decide one or both of these issues in a November special election. Now, one very important aspect of redistricting is the impact that it has on racial and ethnic minority communities. Now, this is especially true in California because we have a large concentration of racial and ethnic minorities, approaching 50% of the population. But in addition, it's important in redistricting because the federal government provides both statutory and constitutional protections for groups that have historically been underrepresented. This takes the form of the Voting Rights Act, which was amended in 1982 and has been used around the country to cover redistrictings. And also, there are constitutional cases where when redistricting is shown to be intentionally discriminatory, it can be held to be in violation of the 14th Amendment. So from both a statutory and a constitutional point of view, there are protections built in by the federal government. One of the things we want to explore is to what extent that's a constraint both on the goal of the governor to create more moderate and more competitive seats and a constraint on minority communities that are trying to get more attention from both of the major parties. So what we want to do is take a look at how the last round of redistricting affected racial and ethnic communities in California, take a look at this notion of competition, whether it's good for California and whether, in particular, there's a way that competition can be reconciled with the goal of minority representation, and also take a look at commissions and whether commissions would be an advantage to minority communities as they look to increase or maintain their representation in the state. Now, we're quite fortunate to have four very distinguished panelists, all of whom have been involved in redistricting. Some of them go back several decades in redistricting. But all of them are quite knowledgeable about the effect that redistricting has had on racial and ethnic communities. Let me just say briefly who our four panelists are. To begin with, we have Kathy Feng, who is from the Asian Pacific American Legal Center. Kathy is was one of the leading people in the last round of redistricting and headed a multiracial coalition that did that appeared at a lot of the hearings and tried to work with the legislature to make sure that not just representation for Asian Americans, but representation for all groups were observed. Steve Reyes from the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund comes from an organization that has been long involved in redistricting in California. MALDEF has been a pioneer in getting the California legislature to consider the importance of majority-minority districts for Latinos. Along with that is Arturo Vargas, whom I met a couple decades ago, who's now with Naleo. But Arturo has been active on redistricting at the local government level and at the state level and is extremely knowledgeable and will give us some historical perspective on how far redistricting for minorities has come in the state. And then Paul Turner from the Greenlining Institute, who among his many interests has an interest in representation and redistricting. So with that, let me begin the discussion. And let me go to Kathy first and talk a little bit about the last round of redistricting with the legislature and what your expectations were coming in and what your sense of it coming out was.
Well, to start out with, the Asian Pacific American Legal Center had not been involved heavily in the 1990 redistricting process, except to provide testimony. And what we did see with the special masters was that that for the most part, the only change that was made was one that benefited the Asian Pacific Islander community, because a community, a Japanese American community in the Torrance area of Los Angeles, had originally been split in the legislatively drawn districts and had been reunited into a single community of interest in a single district by the special masters, the judges who took over the redistricting process when the legislature and the governor couldn't agree. In the 2000 process, we went into it knowing that the law had changed. The Supreme Court had now said that the Voting Rights Act was still a very important protection for minority representation. But at the same time, consideration of representation of minorities could not be the sole consideration. It couldn't be primary. It had to be one of many factors. And the Supreme Court also talked about a new concept or an emerging concept called communities of interest. And so we sat down with a lot of our allies in the African-American community and the Latino community, amongst people of all different backgrounds throughout the state, to think about what does that mean with that changed Supreme Court standing on the extent to which the Voting Rights Act could be brought to bear in redistricting. And we decided to create a model, at least between MALDEF and the Legal Center, where we would go into communities. And we would give them maps of their community, and we would break them up into three groups, and we'd have one group look at race and ethnicity. We'd have one group look at communities of interest, and we'd have one group pretending to be Republicans and Democrats and battling it out. And it was a role-playing, but it was also a way of them starting to assess what are the advantages, what are the disadvantages if we were to draw a district north, south, east, west, a little bit differently than what it looks like now. And what's interesting is through that process, people started to think about race, but in a much deeper way than just looking to maximize where what Asian percentages there were, or Latino percentages, or whoever we happen to be talking to. We created maps that I think were fairly well received by our allies, MALDEF, in the African American community, and extremely well received by the legislature, because we really spent a lot of time thinking about what are natural communities. And let me just give a small example, because it doesn't mean anything in theory until you start thinking about what does it look like in real geographies. I'll use Oakland. In Oakland, the original 16th, the district that had been drawn out of the 1990 process, included the bottom two-thirds of Oakland but cut off the northern part of Oakland, which essentially meant that the African-American community in the northern tip of Oakland had been cut in half. And when we met with a group of community leaders, which included a lot of Latinos and Asian Americans, they played this exercise. And although they could have maximized the Latino and Asian American representation by moving the district south to include San Leandro, they decided that their community of interest was really about Oakland and the transportation issues, the environmental issues, all the other politics that go on in terms of getting better representation for the city of Oakland. And they decided that instead what they would do is draw the district further north, include that part of the African-American community that had been cut in half, and in essence take a much larger view of what it means to have minority representation. That transcending of self-interest is what happens, I think, when you ask normal people, regular people who are not incumbents looking to solidify their political advantage for the next 8 to 10 years, what do your communities look like? How would you draw the districts if you had your druthers? Who are your neighbors and the people that you consider to be allies? Because very often when in California, we're asked to build alliances around issues that we care about, it isn't just based on race or just based on gender or just based on party. We look at who agrees with us and we build a broad base. So the ultimate outcome was that in the last round of hearings, we had a preliminary map that looked fairly good. And then in the last 2 weeks just before the map was supposed to be passed, it went into closed session. And as folks know who've been at the Capitol with me today lobbying on redistricting, independent redistricting commissions, the thing that became the most frustrating part of this whole process that had started out with open hearings and a lot of transparency was that once it went into closed door sessions, we saw a lot of deals cut where if an incumbent didn't like a particular community or a particular constituency, that incumbent could, without any justification to the public, cut a deal internally with leadership, get a community excluded or even cut up into pieces, and not have to be accountable for it. So I would say that the bill that ultimately came out, the maps that we face right now, probably get a B-.
Very good. Steve, maybe you want to pick up a little bit on some of the disappointments that and why MALDEF ended up, shall we say, in court against the legislature. Maybe you want to elaborate a little on that.
Sure. Thank you. Yes. Well, MALDEF came into the process optimistic with the substantial Latino growth during the 1990s to 2000, over about 3.3 million folks, and it counted really for about 80% of the growth in California, and that taking into account the population declines and decreases of other racial groups. And so a lot of the during the decade, what was driving the economy, what was driving much of the population growth were Latinos. And when we sat down with the data, we saw that played out, and we're hopeful that it could result in increased representation for Latinos, perhaps other Latino candidates and new elected officials. But at the core of it, it was a hope with this data that Latinos would have more of a say in who they choose to elect to represent them. And as MALDEF, as with APOLC and other organizations, we went throughout the state conducting the similar types of meetings across from Pittsburgh all the way to Calexico and everywhere in between, and sometimes twice or thrice. And we got that community information. We built that into our plans. And again, we developed, similar to APALC, a comprehensive state legislative plans, and also for the congressional districts as well, that really reflected the increased population growth. One of the districts, of course, where we saw no need to change the contours drastically was in the San Fernando Valley and other places in in San Diego in terms of congressional districts. Some of the natural population growth and the evolution of the population growth there made those very desirable districts to maintain the shape of. And so we left those pretty much alone. And of course, as some of you may know, there were, as Kathy referred to, September 11th, September 12th, day after 2001, day after, you know, our nation's focus was elsewhere. In the dead of night almost, plans were adopted. Significant changes to plans were incorporated with little or no time to actually comment on those. And some of those changes were indeed significant, and they reflected what ultimately became the basis of our challenging through filing a lawsuit in federal district court in California, Central District, a lawsuit challenging based on Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and based on the, as Bruce mentioned earlier, intentional discrimination claims under the Equal Protection Clause. And ultimately, the result was that the districts were upheld, unfortunately. And in our view, incorrectly, the court decided that Latinos had arrived politically, and that some of the major evidence that we had in our case was not relevant to the claim. So the significant amount of intentional discrimination claims and evidence we had was deemed not essentially relevant. There were a number of other kind of bases in the opinion that led to them upholding the districts. But overall, there was a failure to keep pace with the population growth, the significant population growth in the Latino community with those districts. And throughout the process, and I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit more later on in the hour, is at different stages of the redistricting process, there was a lack of openness and transparency that we felt could have been and could still be better remedied and reformed as part of the redistricting process. And that could be under a legislatively based redistricting process, or it could be under an independent redistricting process. And we can get into that a little bit more later.
Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the comments that were made that you found to suggest that there was some racial...
Well, yes, Kathy. There were... In the districts, as you know, there were some... part of our evidence included transcripts and testimony that one legislator threatened to put more Latinos in their district if they didn't stop complaining about what had already been a significant movement of a Latino population into a congressional district in San Fernando Valley. And some of the comments, even at the state hearing level, were, in my view and in Maldives, a bit patronizing. Let's extend some of this population to a neighboring district and give the other new legislator a chance to learn Latino issues and become familiar with that population. And so that didn't predictably sit too well with us.
Well, let's, I mean, it seems from the outside like that there was a split between elected officials and the and shall we say the litigators in the Latino community. Arturo, you've been through this quite a bit. Is that kind of tension rare, or is it something that's very common in redistricting?
First let me issue a disclaimer. I work with the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials, and NALEO right now does not have policy on whether or not our views on independent redistricting commissions. So my comments would certainly be my own personal views, having gone through the 91 process, working extensively actually with you, Bruce, and also having sat on the 2001 LA City Council Redistricting Commission as a commissioner in that independent process. I think what's unique, I mean, every redistricting process is unique, and one of the main differences between 91 and 2001 was that in 91, there were only 7 Latinos sitting in the legislature. There were 4 members of the assembly and 3 senators. And it's hard to remember a day when Latinos had that little representation. Today we have almost 30 members of the legislature who are Latinos, and much of that because of the gains made in the 1991 process. What happened in 91 was that the Latino legislators, and there were only 4 at the time in the assembly, Lucia Roybal Allard, Javier Becerra, both of whom are now in Congress, Richard Polanco, who went on to serve in the Senate and had a big hand in getting more Latinos elected to the legislature, and Pete Chacon, who then represented San Diego. Those 4 ultimately hung together and went to the Speaker at the time, Willie Brown, with the message that unless the leadership of the Democratic Party, who controlled the legislature, did better by the Latino community in the 91 redistricting, that those 4 would not vote for the redistricting plan. And that was something extraordinary to do, for 4 members of the Assembly to stand up to the Speaker and say, we can't support you unless you do something, unless you do the right thing and create more Latino districts. And to me, what happened in 2001 is that the many Latino elected officials that we had ultimately became elected officials first and Latino second. They became Democrats first and Latino second. And they went to ensure that their party was able to maintain control in Congress and that they individually were able to be reelected and didn't see a larger picture in terms of what we can do for the Latino community, which resulted in the kind of situations that that Steve talked about. But I also want to comment on something that Kathy said about the 91 redistricting, and I think she's absolutely right that when coalitions come together, communities can come up with plans that work for communities. And one of the what I call the grand compromise of the 1991 redistricting between Latinos and Asians, over lots and lots and lots of meetings over pizza at lunch, and we all gained like 20 pounds trying to arrive at some compromise, was what to do in the San Gabriel Valley. Because those of you familiar with L.A. County know that there's a large and growing Asian population in the San Gabriel Valley, and there's a large and growing Latino population in the San Gabriel Valley. Both Asian and Latinos wanted to see fair districts. And it came down to, what do we do with these 4 cities that were rapidly becoming majority Asian? San Gabriel, Rosemead, Alhambra, and Monterey Park. Prior to 91, they had been divided into various assembly districts, Senate districts, and congressional districts. And over lots of conversations, the Latino and Asian organizations were able to agree that whatever plans went forward, we would advocate for those 4 communities to be consolidated in the same districts, for the Assembly, for the State Senate, and for Congress. But the compromise came that the Asian community could have said, not only do we want those 4 cities kept together, but we want instead to be linked to the areas that we know are the growth areas of the Asian community, which meant bringing in San Marino and some of the areas in the northeast San Gabriel Valley going towards Arcadia. That would have created, in essence, a Republican district where a white candidate would likely have won. Or we could have linked those 4 cities to East Los Angeles and the city of Los Angeles, creating, in essence, a Latino majority district where likely a Democratic Latino would have won. And ultimately, that's what the Asian leadership and the Latino leadership agreed to. We'll keep the Asian core, but we'll link it with a Latino majority population. So initially, that district was represented by a Latina. Today, that district is represented by Judy Chu. So that is what came out of coalition building in 91. And unfortunately, without the kind of public process and input that we had through the special master's process after the stalemate between the legislature and the governor in 91, we didn't have the kind of public input in 2001 that could have led to those kinds of coalition building districts.
Now, Paul, the African-American community has a slightly different situation than the Latinos and Asians in that they're not growing as fast. How did the last round of redistricting affect your community?
Well, again, I'm representing the Greenlining Coalition, which is a multi-ethnic coalition, and we represent a number of African-American groups as well as Latino business groups and Asian American and Pacific Islander groups as well. But hailing from South Los Angeles, it's often discussed that, yes, even though we are have not increasing at the rate that others are, we are nonetheless increasing. And so it is a bit of a problematic that there is no African-American representation in Northern California, for example. That's often has come up. And in fact, when we talk to our – one of the things we've done in getting involved in government reform, greenlining has not been involved in government reform only until recently. But in getting involved in this, we had a discussion with many of our minority coalition members about what types of reforms and how they – what their attitudes were about the reforms they want to see. By and large, they were all concerned about the influence of parties and their ability to come in their communities and basically make king and queen makers and make decisions that, quite frankly, doesn't involve the type of citizen action that I think occurred that Kathy was talking about and Arturo. And that would be – would help a long way. A lot of that simply does not happen in the African-American community because they are – the African-American community relies on elected officials for political information, unfortunately. And so one of the things that they want to see happen is a continuous discourse about reform and about politics in the African-American community so that the types of citizen action that Kathy was talking about and Steve and Arturo can happen in those communities as well. So, yes, while the African-American population is not growing at a rate fast as others, it is growing and it is lacking representation. For example, one of the areas in which there is growing African-American population is in the Inland Empire of Southern California. And in fact, we've seen people typically think that South Los Angeles is the African-American community, but out of a population of 1 million in L.A. County, only 200,000 reside in South L.A. So the African-American community in L.A. County is out of 1 million is completely dispersed throughout L.A. County and throughout the Inland Empire. So one of the things that we've talked about is how then do we have representation from those areas out in Riverside, for example, in the out towards the river city of Riverside and out towards San Bernardino, where a lot of the African American population has migrated to, and interesting in the Bay Area, also the Vallejo, East Palo Alto, and those areas like that. So while the dilemma is, while the African American population is increasing, it is not as compact as it used to be, and that is what poses problem in terms of how we draw districts, therefore. And so one of the things that has to be done is how do we think out the box in order to make the proportion of African-American population that exists in those areas truly representative of their constituency. And so proportional representation is one of the ideas that's talked about, creating super districts, things of that nature, as a way to provide more of a voice for the African-American population that has dispersed throughout California and not in the traditional strongholds of Oakland, South Central L.A., and those parts that people traditionally think of the African-American community in.
Okay, let's change the focus. This is a good background of what happened in the last round of redistricting, but now we're faced with the prospect of both a change in the process and a mid-decade redistricting. So let's sort of take it apart, and let's consider the primary motivation for the governor's proposal, and that is the lack of competition in California in districts altogether and then also, of course, in minority districts. So the question is California suffering, in your view, from a lack of competition, and does it affect the minority community as well? So, Arturo, let's start with you, and let's try to keep the answers a little shorter so we can get a little more of an interchange between people, okay?
I think it's dangerous to say that redistricting is the only problem with the legislature. Certainly, I think the lack of competition is a major issue in our work to try to get people to vote. It's a problem with members of Congress and assembly members and state senators don't campaign in general elections because their re-election is a foregone conclusion. Any competition happens in the primary. So that is a problem. But I think another problem that needs to be rectified is term limits, because that really is, I think, undermining the effectiveness of the legislature when you are electing assembly members who, in essence, are in office long enough to learn their job and then they're evicted from their office. And it makes their longevity and their view of redistricting much more myopic than if they were looking at a broader picture.
But Arturo, okay. I mean, fair enough. There's lots of other problems, and Lord knows I know about the term limits one. But let's... Are you saying that competition is not a problem for the legislature?
No, I think the lack of competition is a problem.
Right.
And one of the ways it manifests itself that we don't talk about is that nobody campaigns for election, and nobody asks voters for their vote anymore. And that is a problem for the state of California.
Now, do you think, Kathy, that there could be some switch in either criteria or process that would enhance competition statewide? And is there a possibility that we could be doing something to enhance competition with respect to minority communities?
Let me walk through the criteria that the Supreme Court says that we should look at, just so that our listeners have an idea of what we're talking about, and then what a reordering of those criteria might be, and maybe even taking out some of the criteria. Right now, the criteria include things like ensuring that the districts are equal population as closely as possible. So in the Assembly, we're trying to reach districts that are about 420,000. The Senate is 800,000 plus. Looking to make sure that the Voting Rights Act is met, so if there are minority populations, that you don't split them into multiple districts when not necessary, that you don't pack them into a single district when it's a very large community that could be in two and be fairly representative in two or more districts. That you draw districts that are contiguous, so they should all connect. There shouldn't be an island if there's not really an island. And compact to the extent that you don't stretch a district all the way from Los Angeles to San Diego to then, you know, out to San Bernardino. Competition is a criteria that is not well defined, and it's one that is starting to appear in more and more bills. And I would say, in fact, the real criteria that we should be looking at is the extent to which legislatures take into account incumbents' addresses, their constituencies, their self-interest when they're drawing the lines. And if all you focused on were the first set of criteria that I talked about, and you didn't take into account where every single incumbent lives, where all of their constituencies are, and where their enemies are, I think you would already push a map towards being far more competitive than what's drawn right now. So, in short, I would say the easiest way to make things more competitive without drawing some kind of or creating an arbitrary percentage number for the percentage of Democrats versus Republicans versus independents that you want in every district is to simply eliminate consideration of incumbents overtly from the redistricting process.
And many of the bills do that. But now, Steve, in most of the Democratic Latino officials represent majority minority districts, which are relatively safe. But the Republicans have managed to win with Latinos in non-majority minority districts. Do you think that Latino candidates can win in competitive seats? Is this the time for the Latino community to sort of take a risk and say, all right, well, maybe we ought to run some, have some districts, and might there be some advantages to Latino candidates who emerge out of more moderate districts in terms of running statewide?
Well, that's an interesting question, and one which we dealt with during the course of our litigation. One Professor Morgan Kauser of Caltech had issued a study during the litigation. He was one of our expert witnesses, and he looked at Latino populations and the amount of registered voters within the percentage of total Democrats within a district or total Republicans within a district. And he tried to assess what type of patterns he could find within that. And quite clearly you saw that as Latinos were a greater share of a particular party, that it was more likely they would be successful in electing, and for this point it was a Latino candidate. One of the interesting things there also was that there was not enough data to make the conclusions that he was able to for Latino participation and representation within the Democratic Party as he could for the Republican Party. So in my view, it's still an open question as to what that means in terms of do competitive districts, influence districts, and the like. And I think right now there's still the baseline under Voting Rights Act of majority-minority districts, and that still is a factor that must be dealt with in any redistricting scheme or plan or criteria. One of the other things I just want to tag on to Kathy's comment was any one of those criteria, whether it's competitiveness or community of interest or, as she mentioned, incumbency protection, can really have an effect if it's not
considered properly within the context of the Voting Rights Act. And what we've seen, and we've run, Maldiv has run up against and Republicans in Texas and Democrats in Texas as well, and in Arizona and have done battle with Democrats. And so there's competing interests where on one hand we're both seen as political capital, like to fill in the and make a district more safe for either party, and sometimes when you look at that incumbency protection or criteria, it really does run up against the Voting Rights Act. And the same could happen, and the point here is that the same could happen with a competitiveness factor if that competitiveness factor is not explicit in the way it's administered, and also in with respect to its reference to the Voting Rights Act.
Okay, but Paul, same question for the African American community. Willie Brown, able to win San Francisco mayorship. Mayor Bradley, able to win the city of Los Angeles. African Americans representing the Pittsburgh, Antioch area in the assembly. All these areas are a non-majority. Is it possible that African Americans could pursue a strategy which was less majority-minority that might actually enhance the number of African-Americans?
It's totally possible. I'll give you a few other names. Hayakawa, Senator of California. March Fong Yu, statewide Secretary of State for years. Tom Bradley almost became governor. Probably should have became governor if his strategy was different. And Wilson Riles, statewide elected superintendent of education. So, yes. But competition, the lack of competition, is a real impediment to representation. Right now we have a system whereby the representatives choose the voters, not the other way around. The voters don't choose the representatives. And that is the problem, and that's the function we see. We have 153 legislative and congressional seats that did not change.
Mm-hmm.
We have two counties in California in 1976 were decided by a margin of 20 percentage points. In 2004, 36 counties were decided by a margin of over 20 percentage points. So there is a real problem with the lack of competition because it does lead to a lack of representation, especially for the African-American communities. For example, we have, and this goes back to the problem identified before, where the parties become so entrenched in the politics locally that the local community does not have a way to really provide for its own political destiny. Because when you have these majority-minority safe seats, they lose leverage in the state house because they are in safe seats, because they are protected. Therefore, they do not have to succumb to public criticism. They are not have to pay attention to scrutiny. And so they basically sit there and become unresponsive to their constituents as a whole. And they are protected by the money because they're in that safe seat. That's something we haven't discussed, but the campaign finance reform has to be a part of this as well. Whether it's through clean money or some other system, because the incumbent protection also means that they're able to have a tremendous prowess in terms of fundraising, which also produces non-competitiveness. So if we really want to make competitive districts, we also have to look at how do we provide money and resources to challengers also to make these districts competitive.
Okay, so there seems to be a consensus that there are a number of factors that are in the way, incumbency, strong partisanship, et cetera.
Could I add just one thing about the competitiveness issue? I think we need to recognize that California is a very diverse state, and competitiveness in L.A. means something very different than competitiveness in the Central Valley or in the Bay Area or in the Central Coast or in the Inland Empire. And what it would take to get a Latino elected in L.A. in terms of the makeup of a district would be very different than what it would take in, you know, say, in Northern California, where the community is emerging. So to have uniform standards and say this is competitive for Latino candidate and apply that statewide, I don't think is.
So
works.
You despair of having a formula, as some people have suggested in these plans. Some people have suggested that the registration margin be within 7 points. You would despair of something that was formulaic like that in terms of its ability to produce.
Absolutely, and this is one of the reasons why local input, community input, is so important. Something to give some local flavor to what a community is like in a particular section of the state.
I agree with Arturo, and I wanted to add greenlining has a standard of competitiveness, and that is that no incumbent or candidate could ignore a meeting of 20 people at the AME church.
Well, we do need something objective, and maybe that would do. Okay, well, if it's not a formula, but rather it's a process. Let's talk about the commission as a possibility. I mean, tell me what your ideal commission looks like. Kathy, you're segueing into the good government mode,
yes.
Going on to Common Cause. What's a good commission when we see one? How do we know one when we see one?
Well, let me plug a little bit. CGS, the Center for Governmental Studies, and DEMOS came out with a fantastic report that brought together a lot of the good government groups, including the League of Women Voters, Common Cause, Asian Pacific American Legal Center, a lot of groups consulted, like MolDEF. And what we did was we looked at what criteria we would want for the ideal redistricting commission. And we came up with criteria that falls into three categories. The first is looking at what the composition of a panel should be. And what we said was that it should be a slightly larger panel than three or five, which is currently the numbers that are most often proposed. Something like seven or nine, because it allows for greater diversity of ethnic representation, gender representation, and a more interesting interplay between parties, both the two major parties and the non-party.
So, Kathy, if a commission was three or five white retired judges, that would be not acceptable or acceptable?
That wouldn't get us any closer to a better redistricting plan than the crap that we have right now.
Okay.
I think if we had a nine-person panel, and one that required a supermajority. So if you required seven of nine, then you would have to necessarily have Democrats, Independents, and Republicans working together, but not necessarily in collusion with each other. We'd want to make sure that the panel...
Now, what if you do if that? What happens if they don't agree? I mean, the diversity suggests that there'd be some disagreement, so what happens if they don't agree?
We lock them in a room and we don't let them out. There are a number of options for what to do if there's disagreement. One is to send them back to vote on it again. Another is to kick it to the courts. And as we've seen with the 1990 process, the special master's panel of three judges was able to create a pretty good map for California.
Okay, but that panel didn't have any diversity on it.
It was
three older white guys.
I know. And
so you're going to kick it out of a panel that has diversity because they can't come to an agreement, and you're going to kick it to three older white guys because they did a good job in the past. Is that
Let me
you're
just
saying?
Say that I think that what the diversity does is it ensures that when you have public hearings around the state that mm-hmm. the people who are listening are a little bit more cognizant of all of the voices that are coming to testify before them. That's the hope. And besides that, I think it's also a symbolic importance. In California, where no group is now the majority, it is very important that our decision-making bodies look like the people who live here. And so we'd like to see that decision-making body be a diverse one.
Let's let Arturo in on this.
But let's not forget the historical context of the 1991 redistricting. Not only was this three special masters, and yes, there were three old white guys, but we're also coming off of a very important judicial decision in Garza versus L.A. County, where that was upheld by the Supreme Court, where the L.A. County Board of Supervisors was found to have intentionally discriminated against Latino voters in drawing the supervisorial lines in the 1981 redistricting. And as a result, the L.A. Board of Supervisors had to redraw their lines in 1989, that led to the election of Gloria Molina to the Board of Supervisors. So that was very fresh on the minds of the legislators and of the special masters. So there was a great sense of a burden to follow the Voting Rights Act because of what had happened in the federal courts.
And then there's also Kathy's point that the legal climate changed after Charlie Reno, and so
right.
I suppose you could argue that there was more of a legal superstructure that was supporting what was happening in 91 than there is now, so hence the argument for more diversity. Okay, what was some of the other criteria you wanted to talk about for a commission?
So we'd like to see the panel made up of not just retired judges who are exceedingly white and old, but more representative.
Are judges better than citizens? Does everybody believe in this panel that judges are better than citizens?
I think a lot of folks would say that we'd like to see people from all walks of life. I would say that a panel of retired judges also is exclusively lawyers, and I'm not sure that all Californians want only exclusively lawyers to draw their lines. We might want to see academics, Bruce Kane, folks who are
I think I did it once.
urban planners, people who come from all walks of life representing the diversity of California sitting on that panel.
Steve, are you with that? Do you think it judges, or do you think it should be citizens from all walks of life, including political scientists?
I don't think we're sold on the idea of judges as being the where we should have all our hopes pinned upon. And I do think it should, if there is going to be a commission, again, it should be diverse and representative. And I think with judges right now, with taking the pool of retired judges, even the judicial council, I think you're limiting yourself in who can actually sit on this panel or be considered for this commission. I think citizens, commissioners are a good idea to open it up if the idea of redistricting commissions is one that's adopted. And as you can probably guess, that we're not exactly sold on the idea that redistricting commissions or some of the plans that are out here accomplish those types of things that would guarantee diversity and an open process.
Is diversity the primary concern with the questions that you have?
One is the diversity, and also from a good government standpoint, you want to make sure that the commissioners selected or who are eligible for selection are not going to just simply replicate the same problems that are purported to be the reasons for creating a commission in the first place. So some of the plans have conflict of interest provisions and so on that might help limit that.
Prohibitions on people who are lobbyists, prohibitions on people seeking the offices that they created within 10 years of creating those offices.
All right, so conflict of interest regulations. Let's get back to the transparency. Is there any point in a redistricting process where you would want to not have transparency? I mean, should there be transparency for every moment of what a commission does? What do you think?
Absolutely, and that's been the problem. You know, in 2001, the Democratic legislators paid a redistricting consultant $20,000 apiece. To help with these designer districts. So that is a definition of the lack of transparency. So we definitely need to make the process public as much as possible. I would also say that independent commissions are fine, but they're ineffective.
Would you Brown Act them? Would you make it, let's say you know, you're hired as the consultant. Would you be allowed as a consultant to go from office to office and talk to?
I think maximum sunshine is always best.
Arturo, is it practical? What do you think?
Well, I think actually the LA City Council redistricting model was one that proved to be pretty effective. Mm-hmm. It was a large panel, 21 members, and I think what was key to that is it was a diverse appointing authority. It wasn't just a diverse panel, but people who chose the panelists were diverse themselves. It was every single council member plus the mayor, the city attorney, and the controller, and all the meetings were public. And this commission did what we knew that city council would not be able to do, was to collapse the district on the west side of L.A. and move it into the San Fernando Valley. But it also complied with the Voting Rights Act, and that fifth San Fernando Valley district ended up being a Latino-majority district, mm-hmm. now held by Tony Cardenas. Mm-hmm. And it was a very transparent process throughout.
Now, San Diego had a very transparent process. They did all their line drawing on television. That is, the hearings were televised, and all the changes in the district lines were actually done on cable TV. Do you think that level of transparency is required? Or would you allow them to go do the line drawing in the evening and then come back into session and talk about what they did in the evening? Where do we draw the line on the transparency is what I'm asking.
Right there, I think.
I think that technology now allows for that process to be a very public one. Whereas before, if you had a lot of maps, they would be in the form of really long documents that would describe each turn to the east, to the northeast, and, you know, by degrees. And now you can really get online and just publish maps that people can see along with the streets and the highways that they understand so that they can geographically understand what's now happening to their neighborhood. I would say that one of the transparency items that we really want to see in any redistricting commission plan is to ban ex parte communications. And so what we would require is that incumbents, the parties, anybody who's got a self-interest would appear before the commission and testify just like everybody else. And if it's the case that somebody wants a district changed or they want to bring in their constituents or banish from their district somebody who they don't like, they have to go on record to do it. And the voters can then decide whether they appreciate that incumbent for their contributions or not in the booth. And instead of what happens right now, which is they go behind closed doors, they make all sorts of changes, and then they swear up and down that that wasn't their fault, that Berryessa did not get cut up three ways because
To take a random example, because
Manny Diaz went in behind closed doors and insisted that he didn't want the Asian population in his district. So I would say that if people are on record, if they're required to make that testimony, if both parties have to submit in a way that can be published for the entire world to see what their proposed plans are, we have the kind of public discourse that redistricting ought to have and the light that should be shown on it so that people can hold all of those redistricting decisions accountable when the next round of elections come.
Okay, let's take transparency one step further. Steve, you and Kathy spend a lot of time working on public submissions. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a bunch of ideas out there about public submissions. One idea is that the commission only takes a plan which has been submitted. But that may be a little radical. But even if you didn't do that, how do you make sure that a commission takes the hard work that went into submission seriously?
Well, again, and this could be applied equally to a legislatively based redistricting process as well as to commissions, but I do not think you should restrict it only to those who have some of the expertise to and resources to develop very comprehensive plans, either for their local districts or statewide seats. But I think consideration of the public testimony is a vital part. Again, it will depend on how much is what type of testimony is weighed more than others. We saw some previous testimony in the last round where that seemed to be a basis for a redrawing of a district that said, I used to be in this person's district 20 years ago. I want to be back or in this area. And that was a proper basis that overrode socioeconomic considerations and educational attainment considerations. But when in ensuring that that plan is going to be considered, I think really, again, if you relate it back to the commission itself, is that commission going to be diverse? Are they going to have access to the consultants and experts tools necessary to make those assessments? And are those, again, consultants going to be selected in a very open and transparent process? We certainly don't want to have this very diverse commission that's very respectful of Voting Rights Act concerns and so on, and have the consultants who they work with really sabotage those type of efforts or have other interests or agendas.
Okay, well, very good. I think we should switch to the audience questions, the first one is that says the following: recent studies find that independent bodies don't create more legislative turnover. Are we overselling this commission solution? What do you think, Arturo?
Well, it's the voters who should decide legislative turnover, not independent commissions. So I think there probably are a lot of factors that go into how often do you want to turn over a legislature. Term limits, the campaign financing, reform structures. But if all we want to see is a regular turning over of the legislature, I don't know if redistricting is the way to achieve that goal.
Well, now, the interesting thing, of course, is that we have in California term-limited state legislature and a non-term-limited Congress. Does that mean that we should be thinking differently about the redistricting issues in Congress versus the legislature? Because incumbency really doesn't matter very much with the Assembly because at least two-thirds of them are probably only going to have one term left or no terms left at the time of the redistricting. So you don't have to worry as much about its incumbency. So does that factor in? Should there be a greater sensitivity about doing Congress as opposed to the state legislature? What do you think, Kathy?
Clearly, there's a bigger concern with Congress because you have more of an entrenched incumbency. I did want to just speak to this issue of whether independent bodies create or don't create more political turnover, and I think what you've seen in a lot of other states is things where the commission who are ultimately picked are essentially proxies for the electeds. So what we've tried to do with the legislation that we've been supporting, whether it's, and now I'm wearing my Common Cause hat, whether it's Lowenthal's SCA 3 or McCarthy's new version of ACA 3, but it's not one that's published yet, is that we want to build in a lot of protections for transparency, a lot of protections against people who are self-interested getting onto those panels, and some very strict guidelines on what the criteria should be, and removing from those guidelines considerations of things that would entrench partisan or incumbency issue, interests. We think that by really changing the rules of the game, we can make an impact on whether or not there is more representation. Now, I do think I agree with Arturo that making districts more representative or more responsive to voters is a very different thing from whether or not there's more turnover. If you have a district that's drawn better, that has communities that really share interests, and where because there's a slight change in Democratic or Republican percentage balance, that politician has to campaign all the harder to win the votes of their of the people in their constituency, then you have a situation where voters can actually make their voice heard when they care about an issue. And I would just point to the 49th district as an example. There are plenty of districts around California where we saw, because we were advocating for Asian Pacific Islander communities of interest, the shift between Democrats and Republicans changed fairly dramatically. And in the 49th district, which is the San Gabriel Valley district that Arturo referred to in the 1990s, in the 2001 process, we had a similar meeting with MALDEF. We had similar discussions over pizza and much unhealthier food. And we came up with the same conclusion that because of those four core cities and needing to keep them together and building a district around a very large API population, we created a 49th district that ended up changing the Democratic representation, lowering it by almost 7% and increasing the Republican representation by almost 6%. That's probably one of the larger changes that you saw between districts or between registration within a district. And yet the incumbent stayed in place, Judy Chu, because she campaigned very hard to win all of the Republicans who were moved into her district. And I think that's a healthy thing.
Okay, we have lots of questions, so let's try to...
I want to comment on that one.
Okay, quickly, though, okay?
Yeah. And the question was about the competitiveness and the... What was the first part of the question? I forgot.
The question was, recent studies show that independent bodies don't create more legislative turnover.
There is too much emphasis, I believe, on the independent commission and less on alternative voting methods, which will produce competitiveness and possibly even address the issue you mentioned about elected statewide officials versus those in Congress. For example, in Illinois, which has a cumulative voting system, which puts you get three votes, you know, and you vote on three seats, and that's helped diversify Illinois State House. But it's also helped produce at the federal level two African-American senators in the last 15 years, Carol Moseley Braun and now Barack Obama. So we've seen in those cases where alternative voting methods can also be used to diversify at the state level, but also help open up and have a sense of glasnost about the process overall and elect more minority candidates to federal office.
Well, Paul, actually, you anticipated the next question because somebody asked whether or not there was an alternative to redistricting given the problems of community interest and the limitations of geography. Let's try this one. I should have asked this in the first round. What about this mid-decade redistricting idea that the governor has? Let's go across the panel quickly. Are you in favor or not? No waffling.
Sure. I think right now there are a lot of unanswered questions about what data could be used.
He waffled.
Right now I haven't seen anything about mid-decade redistricting in terms of data use that would make me feel comfortable with it. Right now census data is
only... So you're a qualified no.
7 years... Exactly. 7 years old... and there's no provisions in current draft bills and proposals that would identify which data sources to use that would properly reflect the population growth. It was already ignored in 2001 and perhaps already with the undercount, and we don't want that situation to replicate itself in a mid-decade redistricting.
Kathy?
Wearing both my Asian Pacific American Legal Center hat and also my California Common Cause hat, we don't like mid-decade redistricting.
Okay. Arturo?
I will also be a no, and I had to do with what data set you would use to redistrict.
Right.
Utterly and completely opposed.
Well, there we go, unanimity. Somebody please notify the governor. Another question, sensible question from the audience here. Wouldn't increased competition drive up the costs of campaigning and make it harder for minorities to run, certainly from disadvantaged areas? Let's start with Paul. What do you think?
Not necessarily, especially if we have a system of full public financing of elections. And I think that's what has to accompany this redistricting process. That's something we ought to be talking about and pushing the envelope in a way that will really empower minority communities. Otherwise, we're simply talking about re-gerrymandering from what the governor's standpoint is to me. Redistricting without taking into account race that we've been talking about here and how we can empower minority communities also needs to involve how you can level the playing field and have competitive elections as well. And as I said before, that's getting more money and resources to challengers. And the best system that we've seen to do that is like they have in Arizona, where they have an independent commission for redistricting, but they also have a full public financing system called Clean Money, Clean Elections. And that has produced more women to run for office and get elected, as well as more minorities who have run and gotten elected.
Okay, any dissenters on that one?
Let me throw out just another idea, which is we also need to add to that media consolidation. Allow for more free airtime for electeds or people who are running to be able to speak to our public. Huge millions of dollars go into trying to buy ads on television and on radio because we have so much media consolidation. So that would be another way of reducing the cost of running.
Okay, the next question is there any movement to increase the number of legislative districts? But let's turn that around and say, wouldn't the increase in the size of the legislature do a lot to enhance the diversity of the legislature, and would you be in favor of such a proposal? Steve?
Well, I can see how it would be beneficial, and right now there's already districts, these mega districts, Senate districts, congressional districts, and people really don't have that connection oftentimes to their representatives. And I think one way of doing that could be increasing the size of a legislative body.
Mm-hmm. What would you regard as a good number?
Oh, I don't know.
All right.
More Naleo members. That's
there. Right. Okay, let's try another question. Who gets to choose a diverse commission? How would you make sure, short of designating that there has to be a woman, there has to be an African-American, there has to be a Latino, there has to be an Asian, which probably wouldn't fly as
a proposal?
If
you let Steve and myself pick that redistricting commission, it would be very diverse.
But failing that, do we have any ideas about how that might be accomplished? What happened in L.A.? Did they get diversity, and how did they get it?
Well, I think you need to have a diverse appointing authority. And in L.A., you had every council member appoint one person, the council president appoint two, the mayor appointed three, the city attorney one, and the city controller one. So it was large enough, and the interests were diverse enough that you ended up with a diverse panel. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we would look for, is a diverse appointing authority.
Mm-hmm. And that, quite frankly, is the problem with relying on retired judges. I mean, of the 1,500 Superior Court judges we have in California, less than 300 are minority, are Asian, African American, or Latino. So that is the problem with using a pool of retired judges. But something other than that, I think, has to be used to achieve the type of diversity I think we'd all expect in California.
Okay. Here's a somewhat technical question, and that is, could California voluntarily submit the entire state to Section 5 oversight, and would such a step, if included in a redistricting commission initiative, provide appropriate protections for minority communities? This gives us a chance to maybe talk a little bit about what Section 5 is and who's covered, and what difference it makes to California to have that, because Section 5 is up, of course, for renewal, mm-hmm. and there's going to be a big debate nationally about whether or not Section 5 is worth it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends on, I think, at what point a particular voting change is up for consideration.
Well, Steve, why don't you describe what Section 5 is?
And Section 5 is a federal law under the Voting Rights Act which requires certain covered jurisdictions, and in California there are four counties that are covered, that are required to submit every voting change or change that affects voting, whether it's a precinct consolidation or change of a ballot style, et cetera, to the Department of Justice for approval or to the United States District Court in D.C. to get a declaratory judgment on that. And the goal there is to prohibit changes from being enacted and implemented that retrogress and cause a slide back in minority voting strength. In California, Section 5 overall is a fantastic tool that is used to prevent sometimes unintentional, sometimes intentional changes to electoral processes that really harm voters, whether it's poll taxes and different other nomination procedures, et cetera, that really limit opportunity. And, there's certainly Los Angeles County became subject to a type of Section 5 coverage after the lawsuit. That's when new counties are added or after reauthorizations. Maybe we'll see or push for California being one of those covered jurisdictions. But it is an important aspect to the Voting Rights Act that does have some guarantees and that forces and puts a burden on a submitting jurisdiction such as the state or a county to prove that a voting change is not going to be harmful to minorities.
Everybody feels the same way, that Section 5 ought to be renewed, that it would be... Now, what about this idea about... Could you voluntarily say that the whole state would submit, and would that add anything to the process? I've never heard of that. Is it possible?
Well,
or do you have to be covered in order to submit?
You have to be covered to in order to submit, or like I mentioned, it could be a condition of a court order. And I'm not aware of any circumstances where there was a voluntary submission. And I don't think the powers that be here would want that extra scrutiny and second, in their mind, probably second-guessing of voting changes that occur. So.
And by the way, that would be hard to do for an 06 redistricting. If we did the mid-decade redistricting, let's talk a little bit about the timing on that, because presumably you'd have the initiative would be in November, and then you would have to gear up and get the lines drawn, and then you'd have to get them pre-cleared all in time for people to know where they were going to run, which districts they were going to run in. I mean, is this doable even?
Well, let me just add one more thing. California did have to submit its redistricting plan because it had four covered counties to the Department of Justice for preclearance. So there is some element of coverage already. And, yes, you're right, if the whole state was covered and you had to analyze the complete impact across the whole state, it would be impossible, even if it did exist, or if we're trying to push it to California to be covered, for that to be considered as part of the analysis.
But even leaving aside the Section 5 analysis, if you're really having this transparent process and you're really asking for public submissions, aren't you going to run up against some real constraints? Because after all, if you're going to get these lines ready so that people can file all the various county registrars have to sort of reprecinct and get ready for the election, don't we have a real problem if we're trying to do this in this period of time between January and a June primary?
It would absolutely be a problem. It would be a nightmare from, I think, the citizen's perspective. You would have to first be able to figure out what data you are using, what you are looking at, to be able to even look at maps. It's not clear what data we could use that would actually be relevant for 2005 population, given all the demographic shifts in the state. You'd have to mobilize folks to be able to attend hearings within less than a six-month period. I would say probably if something got passed and you wanted to have a map in place by June, I'm sure the registrars would scream and shout, but I'm thinking that you need at least 3 months just to get the lines in place and then allow candidates to file and all that other process. So really you only have 3 months. And then if you want to have hearings up and down the state in a state as large as California with multiple stages, you could imagine that we would truncate this hearing process to only 1 month or 2 months. We have seen in Washington State a disaster happen with King County, where they tried to have redistricting hearings over the course of 1 month. And essentially closed out most people from the city of Seattle because nobody knew that the hearings were happening. They couldn't keep up. They had no time to even be able to gather their thoughts or meet with their neighbors or make arrangements at work so that they could attend the hearings. And it was a absolute shambles in terms of public transparency and public involvement. So I would say mid-decade redistricting, if we're racing to try to make it for June 2006, is a really bad idea.
Arturo, Paul, what do you think?
I think Kathy's absolutely right. I think it's a bad idea, and I think I'm actually in suspicious of some of the motivations of the governor for wanting to see a mid-decade redistricting. I think it undermines the whole concept of transparency and community input when you try to rush something through.
Mm-hmm. Paul?
Yeah, I think the governor should actually try to emulate Hiram Johnson rather than Tom DeLay on this point. And when we talk about statewide, I'm interested to hear Kathy and Steve's take on this. What about the disassociative effect that the initiative process has on California minorities, and if that can be invoked by Section 5? Because while we talk about redistricting, the third way of legislating in the state of California is the initiative process. If there's any process that is completely at a disadvantage to minorities in the state of California, it is the initiative process, because minorities lack the wealth and income to effectively compete to put initiatives on the ballot. And in fact, the initiative process has been used to polarize California along racial lines with Proposition 209, 227, 54, and these types, in 187, for example. So I would like to see Section 5 expanded to include the initiative process, quite frankly.
No, that's
In during the recall election, there was Prop 54 that was one of the initiatives measures up for consideration. And actually, we did challenge under Section 5 the method of administering that, the changing of deadlines, and particularly because it was a racially focused initiative, how that condensation and condensing of timelines really would affect adversely Latino participation in the process. So I think it is something to consider. The ultimate, any change to the process of redistricting would also have to be pre-cleared and those considerations analyzed.
Okay, here's a question that I think has been asked at almost every meeting I've been to for 30 years. Because it's such a sensible idea, people obviously want to ask it. What about the possibility of a totally blind, computerized system doing geometrically compact and uniform districts? That would obviously be a procedurally neutral process. What would be the problem with that, Arturo?
That would be a disaster. I think that's what we saw in 1991 when Pete Wilson then appointed a commission that did just that, and ended up producing a plan that violated not just federal statutes, but I think state statutes, and really was a disaster, because the fact is that people do not live in geometric communities. You know, humans are dynamic, and communities of interest do not form around rectangles. They form around human interests, and we need to have that human interest in the process.
Yeah, actually, a very interesting feature of that plan by Governor Wilson was that it put almost every female legislator in a district with another female legislator. So. Okay, let's take some of these priorities, these criteria, and the question here is, if you take communities of interest, respect for city and county lines, and racial and ethnic integrity, how would you order the priority between the three, or wouldn't you order the priority between the three? Communities of interest, race, and integrity of city and county lines.
Well, actually, the number one criterion has to be one person, one vote, which means equal population of the districts. That has to be foremost, and I think after that, a lot of these other factors would be of equal importance.
So you wouldn't order the secondary criteria. You would, aside from, there's this first tier, the federal criteria, equal population, respect for the Voting Rights Act. But after that, you would not order those criteria. So there's already implicitly an order in the sense that the 14th Amendment and the Voting Rights Act take priority over split cities and county splits and community of interest. So there's already a prioritization, but you wouldn't further prioritize.
I wouldn't.
Okay. Let's a question on sort of nesting. We haven't talked about nesting. Nesting means taking two assembly districts and putting them inside Senate district. It was a favorite concept of the court master. Of course, it was the same person both times, but still. It's an idea that's very popular with people. It's got neatness going for it. They may not live in rectangles, but you can at least divide them into two boxes. What do we think of nesting? Nesting, good thing, bad thing?
I think there's something to be said for nesting. I think that when you think about assembly districts as a building block and you really take into account communities of interest and other considerations in making logical districts that represent a constituency, and then you think of those as building blocks, two for one Senate district, and then 10 Senate districts for a Board of Equalization district, that makes a lot of sense. From the voter's perspective especially, I now understand the links to who represents me. And when somebody terms out of assembly, I understand when somebody's running for Senate exactly what that district looks like. It makes it much harder from a voter's perspective to understand what their constituency is or who represents them when you don't have nesting. I would say another argument for nesting, and there's plenty of counterarguments against it, but another argument for nesting is that oftentimes between the Senate and Assembly, there is disagreement about how to draw the lines. And so you oftentimes see the Assembly drawing the lines for the Assembly a certain way, and then the Senate to punish an Assembly member for daring to draw their lines a certain way, drawing the Senate lines in very obscure, strange configurations to prevent the Assembly person from ever ascending to that seat. And that kind of political retribution can, or sometimes the other way around, creating a district specifically for somebody to ascend into from the Assembly, is less likely to happen when you have nesting. Then it's just obvious two people who are Assembly members might eventually run for Senate, and you're not creating a district for any particular person or against any particular person.
Anybody else want to say anything about nesting?
Well, the nesting that happened in 91, I think, worked well. However, I could see situations where if you're just nesting assembly districts together, you may run into Voting Rights Act problems when you have a minority-majority assembly district and you're stuck with non-minority-majority assembly districts to nest with. You may end up diluting the influence of minorities when you put them into a Senate district by virtue of having to nest as opposed to drawing it from a clean slate.
Okay, very good. Here's a question that actually I'm surprised we haven't actually talked about because it usually does come up. It was alluded to a little bit by Steve, and that is what would be the effect of actually correcting for the undercount with numbers? And let's expand the question and say if you had a chance at a mid-decade redistricting and there was a chance to use some sort of projections that might correct for the undercount, would it actually be something that would interest minority communities?
Well, I think it's a possibility, especially when you consider that under Department of Finance numbers, there for population estimates for 2004, January 2004, it already puts the state's population at 36 million, which is almost a 3 million person increase within 4 years. And so, again, as I opened up during the initial part of the conversation, there has been a lot that has not been accomplished already with the 2001 redistricting. That could provide, with proper use of data and proper, you know, figuring out which data is going to allow that level of accuracy to use this data to help bridge that gap that didn't.
Well, let's say you used the Department of Finance data. You decided that that was a better estimate. Mm-hmm. Would there be any greater legal liability? Would California possibly be subject to some sort of legal challenge on the basis of not using the census numbers? I mean, obviously, the safest thing is to use the census numbers. Mm-hmm. Would you have a heightened risk of a challenge if we did that?
Well, there'll probably be a challenge no matter what form of redistricting is adopted, whether it's IRCs or again, maintaining the same type of process. But with reference to the data used, there's always been battles over what data is appropriate. And again, when there was the redistricting of L.A. County, Leo Strada and UCLA
had all sorts of estimates that was used to buttress and kind of move along from the 1990 data, the census data. He considered birth rates, death rates, school enrollment rates, and a whole number of things. And, of course, that was challenged in court. So there will be always challenges. And I think when you're the key thing is to try and find the most accurate data that can be applied to specific redistricting geography.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about the expense of a mid-decade redistricting? What are we talking about? Are we talking about hundreds of dollars, thousands of dollars, millions of dollars?
I have no idea.
Anyone want to guess?
Clearly hundreds of thousands of dollars. You've got to have... Well, first you've got a special election, which we know is going to be very costly for the state. Somebody want to throw out a number that they know of? I think the number's often quoted in the millions, actually.
Well, 60 million is the usual one.
60 million, thank you. So you've got that price tag right there. You've got the price tag of holding public hearings, second set, in addition to the ones that you have at the ends of each decade. Around the state, you've got to hire consultants who can do all of the maps and publish all of the things that have been submitted, and you've got to take a roadshow around the state. You've got to be able to crunch all the data, so you have to have the computer technology able to take in all of that data. And since you don't have just census data, you now have to crunch data from all different sources and try to put it together. And then you've got to try to break that down to the census block level so that it's actually a geography that people can use to try to build districts out of. So we're just talking about a rough estimate of $60 million plus the expense of having all of those hearings. We've got to be talking about close to $75 million just for all that. And that's not taking into account if there are court challenges, the cost of dragging the whole process through the courts, having both sides hire lots of lawyers from a lot of private law firms, you can imagine that this would really drag on all the way through, hey, 2010, when we're supposed to redistrict again. So what a nightmare that would be.
Kathy, and I think we also have to consider the budget crisis we're in and the numerous cuts that have been proposed in education and other social services and balance that against the cost of doing a redistricting now.
But think of all the fun we'd have.
Please not.
Here's a question that I'm going to sort of twist a little bit. The question is, how do you reconcile the difference between the VAP of minority population and the registered voters? But let me expand the question and say, how do we know when a minority community that has these gaps between the voting eligible population and the regular population and the registered voters, there are gaps in each one of those, that the population is of Latinos, say, is close to, what, 34%, 35%. Then you break it down to what the VAP is. You drop that percentage. You get to the registered voters. And you get to the actual voters, you get down to 14%. So there's a big gap between the population and the percent of voters. So how do we, in a state where there are these gaps between the actual voters and the population, how do we know when we're being fair to a group in terms of representation? What's our baseline?
Well, I think since the 2000 redistricting, there have been additional census figures released that do identify citizenship rates. So in some level, you can use those figures to compare them and use them in consideration with some of these population estimates or even the 2000 census data to assess the differential. And, IGS and...
And IGS stands for?
Oh, come on, help me. Institute for Governmental...
What Studies.
Is Studies.
At UC Berkeley.
Is a repository and number crunching... crunches all those registered data figures, and we do have some sense of how those relate to each other. And, of course, again, the experts that are hired crunch all those numbers and look at the support, look at candidate, look at Latino populations and over time and to see how that those interact together. So, I mean, it's a long, complicated process, and it's – I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Any want to comment? Okay. Let's. If you believe, and here I'm going to take a question and elaborate a little bit. If you believe that out of this special election, you could get a truly fair and bipartisan redistricting system and independent commission, then wouldn't this be a help to ethnic minority and ethnic communities? And then why wouldn't you want to implement it right away?
Steve?
Well, I think there's still problems. There's going to be problems with the data in terms of implementing it. There is, you know, one of the things that was both parties actually mentioned during the case was how changing the district lines would be a huge disruption to the voters and throw their lives into chaos, and you know, maybe that'll happen again. But I think and I forgot the first part of the question.
Well, I mean, I guess the point is that it sounds like what you believe is that what the deal that you got last time out of the legislature was good enough that it doesn't need to be fixed right now. And given the uncertainties of the data and the cost that it would impose on the state as a whole, even though you're not happy with what happened last time, your view is let's wait, change the process. Your view would be possibly change the process. You're not sure. You're not sold on a commission, but you would change the process with respect to transparency and other things for the next round, but not do a redistricting before then.
Yep.
And what this person's asking is, well, why
not?
If you think the process is going to make a big difference, and if you weren't happy last time, mm-hmm. maybe not in 06, but, you know, at some point, why don't you want to change those districts before? Why wait all the way until 2002?
Well, I think changing the process and making sure that it is open, transparent, and it is diverse in terms of the body, drawing the lines, and that there is a Respect for Voting Rights Act considerations and not subordinate those to incumbency interests or other community of interests, for example, I think could yield some positive results. And, again, it's still going to be a balancing in terms of all those criteria, the data, whether, in fact, the resultant bills or plans will truly, and I haven't seen anything yet that really says this is it, this is the one that has all those components. And so I come to this with a lot of skepticism, and frequently in terms of our experience, Maldives' experience in other types of commission settings, and whether they be independent redistricting commissions or just legislative commissions, I think we frequently, as I mentioned earlier, find ourselves competing with and in conflict with Republicans in one state, Dems in another, or both in this state, and so it's still a complicated question, and I don't think it has an easy answer.
I think the simplest answer is that the data isn't there, that the cost is enormous, and we can't afford it given our budget crisis and the things that are on the line, like health care, pensions, and our education. And I think that we don't want to see the redistricting process. Especially the potential for positive reform with a commission just be an act of political retribution. It would taint the whole thing. I mean, the whole point is to clean up the process without it just being one party trying to punish another party because they didn't get what they wanted in the first go-round.
Okay, well, that brings us to the end. You've been listening to a discussion on the impact of political redistricting on minority communities hosted by the Commonwealth Club of California Voices of Reform Project. I want to thank our panelists for their contributions, Kathy Fung from the Asian Pacific American Legal Center, Steve Reyes from the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, Paul Turner from the Greenlining Institute, and Arturo Vargas from the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials Educational Fund. We also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio, and we want to remind you to stay tuned for the next Voices of Reform program, which is on March 30th at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles, where Tracy Western, who's the CEO of the Center for Governmental Studies, will lead a discussion on emerging digital technology and its impact on civic engagement. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 101st year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.